Now, the media sector I work in is very unpredictable. If you're in our sector, there's constantly a new way for people to consume the news that we are producing and selling. So within that, you have to kind of keep your bearings. You have to have some basic truths and foundational dimensions to the organization that hold true no matter what. It's like being in a storm, right?
Hi, and welcome to CMO Convo. I'm Michal Lassman, your host and the global marketing leader. Today, we have the pleasure of having with us Finola McDonald, Chief Marketing and Communication Officer at the Financial Times. Finola, so lovely to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Lovely to join.
Finola, if you don't mind, I know that you've done quite a lot over your career. So you've led global brand, communication, partnership, creative strategy around media institutions. So I would love if you can take us a bit to your career journey.
Yeah, sure. The older I get, the further back in time I need to go with my career journey. And so much happens in media every day at the moment that it feels like a long way back. But yeah, my career has basically been in two parts. There was one false start at the beginning where I went to university to study mechanical engineering because I wanted to be a Formula One engineer. It was all I wanted. But a couple of years into that and book after book full of maths, I realized it's really not what my forte is. I found that I was a slightly more communicative person, that language was more of a thing for me. I was credibly interested in politics, and I was more theatrical, perhaps, than engineering was going to allow me to be. So I rethought things and finished a degree in politics. The first phase of my career, and it's kind of the main bulk of it has been in two halves, was in the public policy development and influencing space. Yeah, an American would call me a lobbyist. So I was a career lobbyist for a number of years at various levels, from very entry until I was head of public affairs at a business lobby group in Ireland. And so that involves, you know, interacting with government officials and thinking about messaging, but thinking about messaging specifically in the way that one could influence with that messaging. So campaign work around political issues or public policy issues, or research about whatever it might be, a business environment in Ireland, or I later went on to work in Brussels and think about the business environment in Europe and competitiveness and all those fun words that we use in the business lobbying sector. So I did that for the first part of my career for, I don't know, 10 years, something like that, a little bit longer. And then a lot of things happened in the world. There was a kind of financial meltdown in Europe. I guess it's 15 years ago now, but back at the kind of turn of the 2009, 2010, we had a Eurozone crisis, as it were. The older among you might remember that, having your equity wiped out in your house. The youngers might not. You might have escaped some of that. But at that point, it was really important to speak to international media about what was going on in my case, in the business sector, and whether businesses were going to recover from this kind of once in a generation crisis. And I did a lot of work then, even though I was based in Dublin in Ireland, I did a lot of work with international media, including the Financial Times, where I am now, including, you know, the CNNs of this world and so on, who were suddenly looking at Ireland because there was a lot happening there around this crisis. And I built a lot of relationships. And one relationship I built was with the American media brand CNBC. So skip forward a little bit later, and I ended up in the happy position of moving to London to become CNBC's head of communications and marketing, as it was at that time for their international organization. So that's the point where I sort of made the leap across the fence from being the person, the PR person calling up media, to working within the media sector, even though I still am, my discipline is still the public relations communications piece. I'm not a journalist. So yeah, I had a happy several years at CNBC, and then I moved to the Financial Times about 8 years ago now. And I really enjoy it because it kind of ties in with everything I've done in my career. I've built to this moment, but I'm marketing or promoting or communicating something that I'm really interested in. Ultimately, I'm a policy and political nerd. I'm interested in the macro economy and all of that stuff that the FT covers. And so it's a good job for me. It builds on what I did before, builds on that interest in politics, but it gives the piece about communications and messaging into the mix. So that's really it. It's been kind of a game of two halves. I don't know what happens next in this portfolio career world. Maybe there's a third chapter, which I can be excited about, but not yet. I'm really enjoying the FT. There's nothing like being in a news organization when the world is upside down as it is right now. For all the stress and worry, it's incredibly exciting, and I'm really privileged to have the job that I have.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much. It's such an interesting story, and it really sounds like a great fit for you to be working then with the FT, right? I mean, if you're coming from that type of background and you're so interested in politics and media and news, et cetera, so I can really sense your passion. So,
yeah, I mean, it wouldn't suit me to be, but no offense to people listening who work in, you know, consumer foods businesses and so on, but I would have just no interest in marketing chocolate bars or shampoos, or you come to know yourself, right? You come to know what's interesting. And I'm very lucky, and not that many people alive are lucky, to be working at something I enjoy. And I think it's a great privilege in life, especially nowadays when it's really hard to get on the career ladder. It's a real privilege to be doing something that is fun and enjoyable as well as a means of earning a living. So yeah, I've been very lucky really in retrospect, but I hope I've got life in me yet, and there's another chapter yet to come. Maybe we'll speak again in 10 years about what Finola did next. Who knows?
My God, I would love that. Thank you. So Finola, I've seen your lovely keynote presentation at the latest London Summit about resilience and pervasiveness. When you think about resilience at an organizational level, what does it look like inside a brand such as the Financial Times?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And if you look up a dictionary definition of resilience, you'll find all sorts of slightly different takes on it. But some people think of it as ability to kind of bounce back, you know, to take a hit and bounce back. Bounce back ability. Is that a word? Anyway, there's a word. I think it's more about consistency in the sense of a brand and to some extent, predictability. Now, the media sector I work in is very unpredictable, whether it's the news flow itself. You know, what did Donald Trump do last night while I was sleeping? Or it's the constant disruption, for example, from AI at the moment, or from various social media platforms, or from YouTube, or whatever it might be. If you're in our sector, there's constantly a new way for people to consume the news that we are producing and selling. So within that, you have to kind of keep your bearings. You have to have some basic truths and foundational dimensions to the organization that hold true no matter what. It's like being in a storm, right? So I'd say for quality media like ourselves and a few other remaining brands around the world, a big part of that is trust and truth. You know, the combination of those two things, I'd differentiate them as truth being something one produces, but trust is the relational aspect of that. It's my readers need to trust that what they see in the Financial Times is credible and accurate, and they can take decisions based on that and, you know, forecast based on that or whatever it is that they do with the information that they digest. And equally, I need to have a trusted relationship with my advertisers that I'm selling them what I say I'm selling them, or with people who give me their data. You know, we're a subscriptions business. We take your data in order to be able to serve you. So you have to have that fundamental kind of set of principles that keep you firm no matter what happens in the world. And that, from a brand and marketing point of view, gives you your differentiation. Even though it feels a little bit mundane and old school, it's really true nowadays that sensible people who read the FT, who are in general, I would call them sensible people, right? People who, you know, they're professional, they're decision makers, they're not that price sensitive, which helps us. They need accurate, you know, information and data and analysis to do their jobs or to live their lives. But they want to know that they don't have to do a lot of work to find information that is trusted and useful. And that's what differentiates me from, no offense if you're listening, the TikToks or the kind of influencer content. Not all of it is untrue or untrustworthy, but you can't tell. It's too blitzy and there's too much of it. So what we have to do is try and lean into that fundamental differentiator that has served the FT well since it was founded in 1888. But equally, we have to respond to all the stuff I said at the start. We have to respond to the new channels and the new consumer desires. People want podcasts. We produce podcasts. People want us to be on social channels. We're on social channels. We're on YouTube, etc. So I think it's that piece of combining, your kind of core principles and values and the pieces that have run through the business for years and years, with that ability, because you've got strong foundations, to kind of sway in the wind and catch elements of the market as it comes and go, or aspects of the industry as it comes and go. So it's not rocket science. And if you were speaking to somebody at another credible publisher, I'm sure they would say very similar things. But that's how I think about resilience, which is some of what we do is very dynamic and changes with whatever's happening in the world. That's our job, respond to the world around us. But we are rooted very firmly in principles that we don't compromise no matter what's happening. And I think that's what gives us the resilience, and that's what allows us to kind of get through storms and survive year after year after year.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. And you know, the Financial Times has been around for more than 140 years. Yeah, so you have this very strong heritage, very strong legacy. While, as you mentioned, the world is fast-paced, changing. There's TikTok now. People are consuming news from social media, and there's tons of fake news as well. So it's a lot about truth, as you said, and trust.
Yeah.
But were there any moments where this heritage, did you feel that it stopped you from being able to move forward or brought to any challenge in this very fast-paced world?
That's a good question, actually. I think, you know, what we need to do is be dynamic, but still know who we are, right? And that comes with lots of things, you know, internal values, you know, trust and integrity and accuracy. These are corporate values at the FT, and we expect anybody who comes to work for us, whether they're a journalist or whether they're a techie building products and platforms, or whether they're a marketeer or whether they're an events person, whatever they are, to kind of hold true to our values. And in fact, in our interview process, you know, we probe that a lot. We want to know that you're serious about the FT and you're passionate about the mission, which is quality, accurate, truthful information, and so on. So that's part of it. So everybody has to sign up to that. Clearly, there are times when it's challenging. You know, we're in an era where they say on the internet about 80% of the content you're reading is what they call synthetic. In other words, it's not generated by a human being. It's generated by some, you know, whether it's an AI bot or whatever it might be. It's not, there's no human oversight. So we insist on having, for example, in our newsroom, human oversight of all of the journalism. You're not reading any content on FT.com that is, you know, scraped off another site or whatever. It's all edited by a real living journalist with really rigorous standards. But certainly that can mean that you're not always first, for example, with news. And again, I'm not a journalist, but we pride ourselves in being right, not always being first. When I worked in kind of broadcast market news, there's real pressure on people with live TV to be first, you know, whether it's first with a breaking piece of news from a prime minister, or whether it's first with, you know, some big business deal that's happening, or first on the scene of, you know, some big incident that's happened. There's a real race there to be there and to be the first person to report it. That always puts downward pressure on the accuracy and the thoughtfulness of what you have to say, because you're literally scrambling to get on television. What I like about the FT is, though, even though we sometimes miss out on things that might be, we would call it a scoop to another publication, or, you know, an event we run for a client, whatever the manifestation might be, I would say that the quality and the caliber of what we do is always second to none, because we're prepared to say, let's do this right rather than do it extremely quickly. And we try and take that across everything we do. It's the same with adoption of AI in our own company. You know, we've adopted AI. AI is kind of a frenemy of publishers. You know, it's a problem from the point of view of a trustworthy ecosystem. And AI companies scrape our content, which you have to pay for because it costs, and churn it out for free inaccurately in summaries and whatnot. So there's all of that that's problematic for us. But equally, AI tools and large language models are very helpful to us. You know, you can do so much, we call it story discovery. You can look at big piles of paperwork really quickly and find patterns and find possible stories that would be difficult for a human at speed to find. So we use it. It's a fine balance. But I think we've been really good at responding to that. We're pretty advanced in using AI, but we haven't gone completely down the, oh my goodness, it's all AI, let's completely adopt. So, because we want to use it in a sensible way, and we want our readers to be assured you're reading human, everything that you read, the final product is always human supervised and created. So there are pros and cons, but ultimately I think we're happy in the space we're in, which is let's have a kind of a good sports car. It's a bit of a sports car, but we're not going to drive it into off a cliff. You know, we're going to drive at the speed limit, but people can rely on us to get them from A to B. So that's kind of how I think about that.
Yeah, no, and I think that it really shows how you still adopted an innovation without breaking your foundation, which is a brilliant and very challenging move to do. Yeah. Especially with a larger team, as you mentioned.
We're big. I mean, the FT is a group. So people often don't realize that it's not just the pink Financial Times, the iconic newspaper and the website FT.com. We're actually a group business with myriad publications. We own a bunch of specialist publications that take you deeper in your industry. We have a big events business. We have a production studio and a B2B research company. You know, we've got this kind of full service person in business model where we can offer you lots of services and products that complement the core journalism. And so we're also trying, the challenge is to bring all those values and that FT-ness, as it were, across a whole suite of things. So it's even more complicated than it sounds, but it's great fun doing that. We're still all quite aligned, and we're still a relatively small company in the scale of international media. And so there's a personal touch at the FT, which I really enjoy. It's a very human company. Very personality oriented. Many people have been there for years. It's a challenge for us to kind of have new people come in, because people stay at the FT because it's a really wonderful place to work and a place you can be proud of. But that means there's a really nice culture of collaboration and trust, which I think is manifest in everything we do. Our industry is kind of funny. Like most major newspapers like ourselves or the Times of London or the New York Times, they were founded in the late 19th century. That's kind of when the newspaper industry came into being. So you'll find a lot of media newspapers as they then were, are about 100 and something years old. And in our case, so we're founded in 1888. Then in 1989, so 100 years later, that's when Tim Berners-Lee comes up with this concept of a kind of a World Wide Web, right? So you have 100 years in an industry of absolutely no innovation, meaningfully. Okay, you might have a print edition that, you know, at different times, or you might have an edition for a particular market. But in general, the print newspaper industry had really no competition and very limited kind of change in the model for 100 years. It was paid for by advertisers and circulated, and also by people paying for paper in the shop. And we did what we did. And it was quite a unidirectional thing. We told you the news and we didn't get any comments back from you because it wasn't. Then in the past 30, 40 years, that feels like a long time now, but it's within our life, it's in my lifetime. It's totally changed myriad
it's such a
times.
Multiplier accelerator. I couldn't even imagine it. It's like a big bang for the
like
news industry.
Like a big bang, and it continues. There's a new thing every day, whether it's Elon Musk, you know, comes on and, you know, here we go, Grok, or whether it's the kind of modern phenomenon of the billionaire buying the news, you know, like Bezos has bought the Washington Post and whatever. And that's not even talking about the technological change from going online to suddenly managing comment sections to now journalism in this multi-platform space. So you would not survive if you were not nimble and on your toes. You couldn't survive. And lots of newspapers have kind of gone to the wall, really, because they weren't able to quickly enough move into an era when, frankly, Google and Facebook and others took all your ad revenue. They just took the whole lot unapologetically and left particularly local. You see hundreds of local publications around the world closing, which is kind of tragic. And it matters to us because it affects democracy and because local papers are famously a kind of a seeding ground, a career starting point for many people who go on to be amazing journalists and amazing marketers and so on in the industry. But it's interesting. I mean, lots of industries are like that, but it's funny that we have this year, this century of really same old, I don't mean that. But you know what I mean. And then all of a sudden, every 6 months, we're having to rethink what we're doing from a marketing point of view, as any marketers listening will know. You have to rethink. You're like, where are my audience? Like even just before COVID, I was printing big billboards down in Canary Wharf, right? Because I thought, well, here's the business community, put a billboard up. Or I don't really do much of that anymore at all, because since the working from home era, where we've gone, the world has gone really digital. We've just had to think, how do we find people? And now we're in this kind of reach scenario of how do I find, you know, younger readers who are coming online, maybe they're coming through a ChatGPT or whatever, they're not coming direct to my website, they don't see my billboard and then go looking. It's a totally different, you know, journey to our destination and so on. And that is a constant challenge and that changes every year. So you have to stay through to your principles or you wouldn't have anything to kind of work with. But you've got to be really alive to what the audience is doing and the audience wants, because that is the premise of marketing and it's the premise of news. If we don't have people reading and consuming or listening or whatever might be the modern way of doing it, we don't have anything. We're talking into the wind. So, I mean, I could talk about this all day, but it's a fascinating industry to look at from a kind of a status quo to a really, really, really challenging few decades that we've just been through and continue to go through from a change, disruption and competitive challenge point of view.
If you have a website and want to get more organic traffic, make sure to check out Ahrefs Webmaster Tools. You can audit your site for technical SEO issues, see which keywords you already rank for, track backlinks, and spot problems that are killing your traffic, all without paying a dollar. Completely free, no trials, no credit card. Just connect your site and start fixing what matters. Head to ahrefs.com/AWT and get access today.
So one thought comes to my mind, it's not only how do you find new audience, it's also how do you keep the attention, which leads me to the next question, which is around brand.
Yeah.
So I would love to get your perspective. Where do you believe that now brand could have the most strong impact or the most strategic influence? Because I know that now, especially with the rise of AI, and we know that, and rise of social media, et cetera, we know that there's a lot into brand, but maybe you can help me unpack that. What does that actually mean from the financial time perspective?
Yeah. I mean, like most businesses, we have a relatively complicated marketing organization. It's not linear, and there are different teams who serve quite niche audience types, some of whom are clients and sponsors who want to be adjacent to our audience, some of whom are core readers, and some of whom are business corporates. So, you know, many of our readers are people who read the newspaper every day or who log on as themselves, like you would log on as Michal and read your MyFT and see what's happening. But equally, we have a lot of corporate customers who log on a kind of a license through their enterprise, right? And they see a different interface and they have a different experience of the FT. So for that reason, we have quite a distributed marketing organization and people have different roles within that. I think about the brand all the time. That's kind of key to what I do. And I think what I have to lean into is the trust piece. How I think about that is, you know, one, it's the differentiator, as I mentioned a couple of questions ago. But also, you know, what we're doing, what we're selling, and we're not here for, you know, we have to pay for ourselves. You have to pay for an FT subscription. It's not the cheapest thing available on the market, but we consider it an investment and we would tout it to you, promote it to you as investing in yourself, investing in your company, because it's news you can use and it's incredibly kind of valuable if you're in different types of industries. So we talk internally about we're selling truth, we're selling trust. And I think I said earlier, truth is a kind of a thing, whereas trust is a feeling, it's a relationship. And I think our brand really plays into the trust space, because what we're trying to do is expand and monetize the trust concept, which is relationships. So go back to what I said about for many years, we were a newspaper telling you what we thought and we didn't much care or listen to what you said in return, unless you were one of those people who wrote a letter to the editor, a dwindling type. Now, on any website, the comment section is almost more lively and more colorful than the content. The content is a catalyst for a community of people who love the FT club, who are signed up to what we do and who want to debate each other as much as they want to debate our columnists and journalists. And then we have our FT live events business, a multi-million pound business, because those people want to be convened in the same room. And of course, there's journalism on stage in thought-provoking content. But just as important to them is the community aspect of everything we do. And similarly, other products and services that we have. And I say all of that to say, that's where I think about the brand as really important, because the brand does so much to tell people that they're in a safe space with intelligent peers. That sounds patronized, but, you know, peers who also read, who have balanced, level-headed things to say, who they can learn from, who are global, so bring different perspectives. So we're not just thinking about the brand as the actual content and, let's say, the pink FT for the sake of the conversation. We're also thinking about the brand as the community around it, the community that consumes our content, that comes to our events, that follows our journalists on, you know, Instagram, wherever they follow them, who read the FT Weekend, taking our steer on where they should have their dinner on Saturday night, or, you know, where's in fashion for a holiday this summer. And I think that for us is where the brand really sings, because, you know, the performance marketers and kind of growth teams can do the more utilitarian piece of, for X amount of money, you get all this content and it's really good value, and why wouldn't you do it and do all the onboarding and really make people feel at home. My job is to make them go, wow, I really like it in here. I really like it. I don't want to leave. I'm in a very special club and I don't want to leave. Now, I can do that because of the nature of my business. But I guess for brand people in other companies, you're just trying to think about that. You're thinking about what is the value of this unique kind of space or decor that I have created around my company, and how could I monetize that? How can I show that there's value? Because traditionally, you know, brands, it's kind of an intangible, right? It's easier for a CEO to go, yeah, put all that money into that performance campaign than it is to say, here's a lot of investment for brand, because it's a kind of an intangible. But my goodness, does it pay when you go large on brand? I really believe that in the world that's ever, ever more busy, and when I open my phone and I have ever more apps, not just news apps, but, you know, music and different things I can do on the train, what's going to bring me into that pink FT app? It's not just the color of it and the news. It's the experience and the sense that I'm in there with other people who think like me, or who I aspire to be like. And I just think that's one of the things I think about all the time, relentlessly. How can we continue to evolve that so it's relevant to people, but it feels like a place you cannot leave? You would really hate to be unassociated with the FT after having experienced it. So that's what I think about. It's the special sauce on top of the utility and the usefulness that you get from the product you buy. It's the something else, that special something that makes it feel more boutique and more special and more kind of personal and luxurious in some respects.
Yeah, so it sounds, I love how you framed it, because it's not just about trust. It's also about look, feel, experience, but then also one very important thing, emotions. Yeah. So how does a person feel when they log in into the app? So I think that is something that you're describing in a beautiful way. I would love to hear.
That's the thing for people who do user experience in apps, you know, tech people who think about your experience. You want to go, this is such an enjoyable experience. You know, we'll all have websites, fashion websites or wherever, where you go to buy clothes. And sometimes you go, I really like this experience. And other times I can't be bothered trying to navigate this, much as I like the product. So it's not just the brand piece, but it's helping everybody kind of think about the brand when they're doing their piece. So it all feels quality and it all feels seamless and it all feels like you're in a place where you are going to have a good time, right? And you're going to want to come back again and again, because we know what you want and we are there with it for you. And I don't know that all brands have kind of fixed that, but each to their own, right? It's a different place in the priority list for any given company.
Yeah, 100%. I think that, you know, as you mentioned, still there is this perception that brand is much more of a cost center than a revenue engine. And I think that you've summarized it beautifully why it's not a cost center, but rather a revenue generation as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've touched a bit about it, but I would love to unfold it, the topic of change. Yeah. So the result of change happening in news and media, how do you translate that also internally? How do you ensure that the leadership and the teams can withhold this type of change? And what does it mean from the internal side?
Yeah. Everybody loves change.
Actually not. I think most people hate it, you know.
Well, this is an eternal. Anybody you're speaking to on this show will say change is really hard. Change is hard for everybody. And, you know, think about me. The older I get and the more curmudgeonly, I really don't cope with change. If I come home and someone has moved a chair, I've just moved the furniture in this room to do this podcast. And I know that when my husband comes in later, he'll be like, what happened to the furniture in the room? Like even the smallest thing is kind of, it throws you, right? It throws you. And clearly, if you work in an organization where you're comfortable and you know people and you've had a particular way of working, change is like, it's a bit nerve-wracking, right? It can be frightening, and sometimes you can't see what is at the end of it. But it also, it's just work, right? It's just work. You know, when you work in a news organization, there's a kind of a latent, I'll call it stress with a small s, that just comes with, you're hyped up a lot because there's so much happening, right? What's that movie title? Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's a sense of that sometimes in a modern, let's say in a newsroom, but even in a marketing, a responsive marketing team where you want to go out with, we've got this story, quick tell the world, where, you know, for example, in this Trump era, there's so much news because they're, strategies flood the zone. We're flooded all the time with stuff, right? The stuff could be breaking news, and the stuff could be invitation to an event, and the stuff could be join us online now for a debrief. So all of that is happening apart from the intentional change that you want to create. So I'm no change connoisseur. All I would suggest is that you have to paint for people a strong picture of where it brings you, why it could be helpful, and give them a sense of what comes at the other end, why things would improve. I talked to you earlier about the fact that we are a group business, for example. So we've got the Pink FT, which is a big, it's the bulk of our journalists, and there's a whole infrastructure around the core Financial Times product. But equally, we have other publications, we have events, we've research team, we've a whole bunch of other teams and offices all around the world where they have their own cultures and their own time zones and their own ways of working. So bringing deep organizational change can be really tricky. You need local people to, you know, people on the ground who can kind of help with feedback loops. And this is how it's going down in, you know, in our case, the Philippines or in Bulgaria or in the US, whatever it might be, because we are headquartered in London and we have quite a, I would suggest we have quite a kind of British culture, even though we're a global organization. And you have to be mindful of that. Change can feel quite different in different places, depending on how close you are to the center and how well you understand what people are trying to achieve, right? Sometimes it's hard to understand what management is trying to achieve if you're further away from the center. So I think it's a good sense of why this is an improvement, why it will feel better for you. For example, classic moving from kind of print to digital was a massive endeavor for most news organizations. The working from home era, I think showed multiple organizations that even though it might feel impossible, it's doable. Like we went almost overnight. We were one of the first news organizations to go home in COVID. We were testing our systems. Could we cope? Could we do it? And we thought we'd be a week testing this. And the next day we were like, go home. So it's incredible when you create a kind of a deadline, how quickly people can act. But in a real change process, I think you have to paint a picture of why the future state, whatever it might be, is better, what it is that's going to help you do your job, whether it's introduction of AI, kit and caboodle, and giving people the time and investing in training them to use it and how it's going to make life easier for them, whether it's creating that feedback loop piece or whether it's reallocating budgets, for example. Should we invest more in brand this year? Should we invest more in something else? And just being able to see that the core of being a successful news organization is the dynamic culture and the ability to change. It's less about what the individual change is, because it could be a micro thing on a given day, or it could be a fire alarm. We have to go outside. We still have to pump news out, or it could be a mega thing, disruption. Somebody swoops in and buys a competitor or whatever it might be. So I think the key challenge is building in the mindset that we can change. We could change at any time because this is the industry we're in. And then having the right people and relationships on the ground that allowed you to try things, paint a picture, create feedback loops, listen to people. And then you have to focus on the people who are with the program. I mean, there's only so much work you can do around folk who just don't want to change for whatever reason. You have to lead with the ones who are willing to be ambassadors and to, you know, do the dance and show how it can be done. So I don't have any guru book on how to do by any means. I just know that I cannot work in the industry I work in and expect to wake up every day and find that everything is the same, either in the small sense or in the really big mega sense. And I think most people who work in our industry would understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, your people have changed, that is for sure.
Yeah, consumers change and generation. I just watched a YouTube video earlier of a chap in the States delivering a speech in a college. It was supposed to be about, you know, linguistics and languages and the importance of learning second languages. And to make it very relevant to the audience, I loved it. Well, it's a YouTube video. It was nice and short. The guy was really engaging speaker, but he wanted to make the point about languages, but not make it in this kind of patronizing. Oh, one should know many languages. It wasn't a lecture. He delivered this little lecture in Gen Alpha speak, right? It was all full of the I finna this and I finna that and whatever. And it was just so on point. And they loved it because it was making the point that they already are multilingual. You know, and stuff changes, and the more it changes, the more it stays the same, and that all languages are moving, and so on. I just found it really, and I think about stuff like that all the time. How do you actually show change, but show people they're already doing it in some way? Show them that they're already operating at a level they don't even realize. And I just think stuff like that is really, it's fun and it's engaging, but it's a real moment of speaking to an audience literally in a language they understand, with a bit of humor, while also imparting a really valuable message about, isn't it great that you can understand me now and you could also understand me when I was speaking plain English 10 minutes ago? And I don't know, there's something in that about adaptability that, you know, I think it's just really important. Now I'm going to have to Google that guy and tell you what he was.
Yeah, I would love to get
the
link.
I'll watch it later, but you'll find it online if you look up Gen Alpha lecture on languages. It's just a bit of fun, but there's something in, there's an important message in there if you have time to unpick it. I really enjoyed it anyway.
Yeah. Finola, as we are entering the end of this episode, although I'm having so much fun, I would love to ask you, we are currently opening 2026. What are some tips or advice you can give to our listeners around the evolving role of marketing leaders, chief marketing officers, etc.? What is it that they really need to hone down on in 2026?
Yeah. It's a good question. I won't patronize. There isn't each to their own piece of that. But it feels to me like the world in general, marketing exists. I mean, there's a real touch point element to marketing, right? You know, I buy this thing. What does this thing feel like? And how do I interact? But so much of it exists in the ether, right? It's emotion and it's messaging and it's stuff that you can't touch. It's just, it's there in your mind and it's in consumers' minds and it's kind of on the airwaves, but it's less tangible. I feel in this era of real synthetic-ness and fakeness and made-up-iness, you have to double down on the core of who you are. And there might be a bit of pulling in your horns. Like, I think sometimes as marketers, we're guilty of chasing every whim, you know, whether it's, you know, big companies who changed their name, you know, they do a rebrand, they're trying to make it cool and it backfires because they just thought, oh, that was cool. We thought everybody liked this and then it doesn't work. Okay. There's that kind of thing. There's also the bit of chasing newer, younger audiences or customers. It depends what you're selling. But, and I'm not saying you shouldn't chase them, but you don't have to always go to, having said what I just said about the Gen Alpha guy, you don't always have to go down the rabbit hole of speaking that speak. I think we pull ourselves apart sometimes trying to serve every potential customer rather than really doubling down on the more old school thing of really making current customers feel great and then thinking about how to kind of share that experience with the next layer of possible, in my case, readers, in someone else's case, consumers or wearers or whatever it might be, or B2B customers, the kind of next layer out. I think sometimes why CEOs and other colleagues think we're a bit uninvestable is because we can get caught up in fads, which can mean different things to different people. If you're the type of company that can pull off a fad, great. But you can really spread yourself too thin. So to my mind, 2026 is a little bit of thinking about the future, because we're in the middle of writing a new strategy for the FT for the next 4 years. So we are thinking ahead, but we're also thinking, what are our core strengths? How do we go back to the core strengths of our brand and business and invest in them and build them out for a modern era, rather than starting with, you know, what's going on out there, which I think can be overwhelming. And I just feel like sometimes marketeers, and I do it myself, I think, what am I talking about? Why am I even contemplating this particular demographic or thing? And it might be because I've just been to an event and I've gone, oh, look what Nike are doing, or look what, the New York Times are doing to bring it to my space. And I go, that's cool. I got to mimic that. You don't have to mimic that. You do you.
Thank you for saying that. I think that that's a great way to summarize it. You do you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you waste so much of your own time, right? I waste my own time all the time because I live in this theatrical dreamer world at times, but I can't be wasting the company's time. I have to rein it in. I have to think, right, I've thought about it and now I've settled on this is the thing. And equally the team, you can be creative, do fun things and innovate and do new things, but don't try and do them all at the same time. You will run yourself into the ground. That's my view.
Great. I think that that's a great way to also wrap up the episode. Finola, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. I will take on, you know, your check in 10 years from now to check where are you in the next chapter. But I hope that we will be talking and speaking much sooner. So thank you very much for being my guest.
Thank you very much. And as I said to you before we came on air, I've just started wearing glasses for the first time. So remember that in 10 years and see what kind of aids I have then. What am I? I might have a hearing aid. I might have grey hair. I feel like I'm genuinely aging now. So I look forward to talking careers in 10 years, but also trying to look my best as I try to keep myself together in the top half of my life. But there it is. Thank you, Michal. It's been really good fun to chat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of CMO Convo. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and review on your preferred platform. Don't forget to tune in next week for another insightful conversation with the leading CMO.